Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by the Dans, and it is time for the best words in lacrosse high school recruiting podcast world.
What's up, Preps Nation? How are we doing, everybody?
We are doing great. We are recording this on September 30th, which means that we are basically 1 month into the recruitment for the class of 2027. As Dan Kaplan and I discussed over the course of the summer, it is very difficult to make these schedules or to make our schedules work in order to be able to record these shows. So we apologize. We actually haven't recorded since the 2027 rankings dropped. And because so much has developed with respect to those players' commitments, as opposed to talking about them in specific, talking about the rankings in specific, we're going to talk about the rankings kind of in conjunction with how guys made their college choice and how the class rankings came together. But first things first, how's everybody doing?
I'm great. Tuesday, but I had an awesome weekend, so I feel energized and ready to kick ass this week and hope you guys do as well.
Dan Aver.
Right. Doing great. I think everybody here is probably pretty glad to be over with the summer and now into kind of what we call our own little summer, which is just like a relative break in some of the intensity of lacrosse coverage. So, yeah, we're doing good in that sense.
I always push back on that. People say that to me all the time just because there's like a volume of it, but I love being on sidelines. So I push back there.
Sorry. There you go. Well, let's talk about the last month. Obviously, the volume of visits and commitments has been exceptional. As of Sunday night, so September 28th, there were 320 players in the class of 2027 who had committed, and that doesn't include the guys who committed to the three service academies prior to September 1st. Cap, what do you make of the speed of commitment?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, like, so for me personally, like, the speed from this year and last year, like, is kind of eye-opening just to, in general, top-end recruiting and how it all works for these guys at this phase of all of the rules, right? And so we're still relatively new into this stage of, like, the recruiting timeline. And coaches, people, ourselves, everyone's still kind of navigating exactly how to work that process. And so for me specifically, over the course of the last 2 years, to have really redirected an eye towards that specifically, I think it's pretty intense the way that it all unfolds and in such a quick window. One of those things that, like, it just happens as a result of that is, like, the schools with bigger budgets, with, you know, whether it's a super appealing academic offer or whatever else, are just able to move really quickly. And so I think all of that is, like, you know, pretty informative and defining for what the month of September looks like in terms of commitments. But in general, the speed is pretty fascinating.
Dan Aver, what were your thoughts on the first month of commitments?
I would agree a lot with what Kaplan said, and I think that what we saw this year and this past year is that I think the recruits have a little bit more time than I think maybe we or they thought that they did. We're seeing like a lot of those five-star guys and some of the top-tier four-stars commit around the middle of the month. So I think when we came into these new rules, there was maybe this assumption that, you know, all these players would commit on September 1st or within the first week of September. But what we're seeing is actually, like, guys taking their time, doing their visits, entertaining maybe more than a few options, and then picking around the middle of the month towards the back half of the month, which I think is, you know, it's not what I would have expected maybe 2 to 3 years ago, but that's how it's kind of panned out. And then I think otherwise, go ahead, Cap.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. So don't lose your train of thought there. But for me, I feel like the point that you just made is so specific to, like, very, very tippy top of the class that is afforded the luxury of being able to go on visits and shop and not have to be worried about, like, getting put on any type of timeline or anything like that, like, early in their process, that allows them the luxury of being able to shop and go visit different spots without worrying that you're going to end up with, like, passing on what ultimately was your best fit. You just didn't know it yet. And so I think I agree with you in parts that, you know, there are definitely a handful of guys that, get to go through that process with that luxury of like comfort of knowing that no matter what, it's all going to end up working out for them. But I think the anxiety that a lot of kids face during that time is based on that uncertainty of like, yes, you are allowed to go and shop and do your visiting, but it only comes with comfort of knowing that you could still potentially end up at your best fit for, you know, a handful of guys. And I think that that's, you know, part of what, like I said, adds to the intensity of, you know, commitment season.
Well, let's dive into some of the specifics, because I think that when you take a step back, certainly the reaction that the public has had to the group that North Carolina put together is jaw-dropping. One thing for context, we have developed this formula, and I know, Dan, you're in the market for a better explanation for how it came together, that really doesn't have much of an explanation. So Patrick McEwen, our data specialist, he gets shouted out on this podcast a lot, basically created a formula that worked backwards on the pairing the way that our old subjective class rankings compared to individual player rankings, but the math itself doesn't stand on its own merit. However, when you spin it forward, it does have a similar level of reflective quality. So that's why there isn't really a good explanation. And one of the things that we get asked about a lot is, why are there two sort like numbers, like, or rankings? So there's the points rank, which does have like a mathematical backbone that's more easily published. It's basically just the distribution of the player's ranking and their star rating that kind of swirls up into a point total. But what it doesn't do is as adjust as well for the differences in class sizes. And that's why there are two, and that's why, you know, the primary ranking list, the number that is actually like underpinning that is the predicted average ranking. And so, for instance, in the class of 27, the predicted class ranking for North Carolina was 1.55. Oh, excuse me, 1.52. Misread that. In 26, Notre Dame's top ranked class was 1.469. So while this is certainly a really impressive group that Carolina has put together, it's not only not historic, it's not even not historic on the basis of the last 2 years. But with that being said, it is a very impressive group. And one of the things that was really notable was the novel strategic approach they took to building the class. And I think at this point, based on what was shared on social media, it's kind of an open secret that there were a lot of guys that were on campus for North Carolina's September 1st football game that was on Labor Day Monday night. And that had, you know, a relatively strong impression when you look at the fact that the Tar Heels got a commitment on September 2nd. From Luke St. Pierre, a five-star defender, on September, also on September 2nd, from Grant Hamner, Griffin Hamner, a four-star defender, a commitment from four-star goalie and number 65 overall player Jet Stake on September 3rd, and then a commitment from number 53 four-star faceoff specialist James Headley on September 5th. And it continued from there by putting together a really stacked offensive class that featured the likes of Trip King, a five-star attackman slash midfielder out of Southern California. More pure midfielder, the number three ranked midfielder in the class in Anthony Asaro. And then a trio of really talented, just kind of pure offensive players. Lefty Chris Colsey, a five-star, he was number 19. Cole Stankovic, a five-star, he was number 16. And then the capstone, James Holbro, the number one player in the class. Dan Kaplan, how do you describe the group that North Carolina put together?
Yeah, I think if the class had finished on the 15th, so it didn't even include James, you would have still been really happy with that Tar Heel crew. And then to actually get, you know, the number one player in the class on top of it and have that like true quarterback factor, incredible feeder that's going to make all of those guys in the class even better than what they would be of just on their own. It just gives so much to be excited for. I thought it was really interesting how quickly people went to like the data of like, yeah, but North Carolina getting good recruits isn't, you know, news or anything super new, and has it translated. And so I think that element is only going to be like under a pressure cooker now, especially with the recruiting success of the last 2 years. But like I said, I feel like from the structure of the class, you would have been happy with who you had, the roles you were projecting those guys to fill, and kind of just like the positional needs. You would have been really happy with it. So then to land James on top of it is just this like ultimate icing. And I think the way that it manifests isn't just necessarily like, oh, we got him and he will be the future, but we got him and he's going to make a lot of other recruits that we've yet to get on campus that are committed much more dangerous during their time there. And I think that's all what is really exciting.
Abram, your thoughts on the Tar Heels?
Yeah, I mean, to reiterate a lot of the points that Cap said, like, I think what's most impressive is not necessarily the class, because as he mentioned, like, North Carolina is no stranger to elite recruiting classes, but it's just so much like the domination of the market to come in and nab six, you know, five stars. And, you know, they had five stars and then they go and get James Holbrook. It's just like, wow, like, how did they do it? and then on top of that, they've got so many other four-star recruits that are, you know, highly, highly praised. The narrative now is like, what can Carolina do with it? Because as Cap mentioned, like, there's this talk that like, well, North Carolina has always had really elite recruiting classes, and yet they're, you know, haven't exactly materialized into Final Four appearances. So there is a little bit of pressure there to kind of capitalize on this class, because I think when we look at it, like, this is a class that you get to build a Final Four caliber team, a championship level team. So there is going to be a lot of expectations with this class going down the road.
And then I'll just quickly add to that. And obviously, like, you know, we're talking 27s and this timeline is very, you know, 27 focused, but they also flipped one of the best 2026 face-off specialists in the class as well during that week. And so that actually happened on the 19th. And so that was just like a crazy week that manifested into some big time recruiting news for the Tar Heels. And, you know, it can't be stated just what the momentum of that 2027 class will have, but, you know, the 26s are really good as well. And so getting those both of those classes on campus is going to be, you know, nearly 20 top 100 players. And so, you know, you just got to think that, like you said, that pressure is starting to materialize, but you also have to feel like, you know, you have the right guys in the boat to actually get it done. All right, let's keep it moving here. I have a couple other thoughts on just general class outlook and the way that this group materialized. North Carolina, we have sitting at the number one spot right now. And then when you look at number two, it sits pretty heavily weighted towards Notre Dame. As we mentioned earlier, you can check out the points rank, and there's also the actual points, so you can see the margin of difference in terms of when it will shift and that type of stuff. And so Harvard sat at two for a while. Notre Dame sits there now, and it took them bumping Princeton out of the way to actually get there. And so as we look at the course of the top five, we hit on North Carolina already, and then it goes Notre Dame, Princeton, Penn State, and Harvard. And so when you look at the forming of those classes, the one that really sticks out to me is Penn State. And I don't mean to skip over Notre Dame or Princeton, so Abram will be sure to come back and hit on those guys. But I think that Penn State being at four and then some other of the Big Tens falling in the top 10 is just kind of indicative of that first point that we were making, which is like some of these top tier institutions that have athletic money right now are able to go and spend in ways that, you know, are really impressive. And I think it's pretty clear that Penn State falls in that category.
Yeah, I mean, I think when, you know, we've been chatting kind of like on the side about Penn State's class, and I think everybody at all of our staff at Inside the Cross is really impressed with the haul that they've gotten. But to sit here and say, like, wow, like Penn State's the number four class, you're clearly the best class in the Big Ten, is just so impressive. And I think it kind of speaks overall to not only the success that they've had on the field over the past couple of years, rallying off a few Final Four appearances, but just I think the commitment from that coaching staff to, you know, emphasize younger coaches getting out on the road and connecting with some of the players, and also just a commitment from the athletic department. Like you said, I feel like, you know, when we've talked about some of these institutions that are primarily known for football, like a Michigan and Ohio State and a Penn State, like I think Penn State's kind of like building out that blueprint of like what, you know, a high tier football school can also bring to the table in terms of a lacrosse school. So it's been really impressive. I personally am a big fan of a lot of the players that they've gotten. Like, I think that they are really kind of building like a Final Four caliber, you know, a class where they're going to pretty much build their program up from this class in the hopes of competing for a national championship one day. It's just really impressive. But let's go back to Notre Dame and Princeton, because I think that to a point I wanted to make earlier is that, you know, I think the question of this summer revolved around this big three of James Holbrook, JT Cross, and Riley Woods, who was the number one player. And coincidentally, North Carolina, Notre Dame, and Princeton were all able to grab one of those guys, and pretty much those guys became the cornerstone of these elite recruiting classes. And they've been able to augment and build around those players in really impressive ways. And I think when you look at Notre Dame and Princeton's class, it's kind of a coin flip. Who's the number two or number three class? I think Princeton has more five stars, but Notre Dame overall is ranked higher in both terms of our algorithm percentage, but also in the points ranking as well. So that's kind of like a bit of personal preference, but there's the way that we've mathematically categorized it. But I want you to delve into that class a little bit more, because I think that, you know, Notre Dame and Princeton fans are also very excited about what they brought to the table.
No doubt. And they should be. And I think kind of what you asked is sort of two different questions. The first of which I'll answer is kind of how things to me shook out between James, JT, and Riley, right? Riley being a little bit different, you know, just has a little bit of a different process than James and JT did. And one of the pieces of evidence to that is just how quickly he committed relative to those other two. And then JT committed on the 18th, James committed on the 19th. Not necessarily that those were dominoes that were dependent upon each other, but does symbolize that they were decisions that were made probably around the same time. And so I think that aspect of things is interesting. I think JT and James both fall in that boat that you talked about earlier, which is like they didn't know exactly what they wanted from the start. So they wanted to do their homework, and they were afforded the luxury of being able to go shop with as much comfort as they wanted, because if any of those schools decide to pull an offer from one of them, it's like, all right, well, I'm going to make you pay for it. You're crazy, you know? And it's like, either way, if you pull from one spot and you end up at another one, like a lot of times it becomes apples to oranges and preference, right? And so, again, it's like you can pretty much take some sort of full confidence knowing that you're going to end up in a really good spot with a great financial package. So those guys kind of fall in that as well, but just didn't know exactly what they wanted from the start. Whereas Riley, it seemed like he knew he wanted an Ivy League. It felt like it was between Princeton and Harvard for a long time, and then was able to visit both and make a decision on the backside of that. And so his process relative to the other two were very different. But like you said, when you get one guy in the boat, it kind of allows you to start to shape your class. It allows you to tell people like, hey, we're only taking this many attackmen. We already have this many attackmen committed. Like, I'm not trying to, you know, put you on an intense like timeline or force your hand. But at the same time, there is an element of speed that, you know, it is a relevant factor as well. And so, for Princeton, I think once Riley was in the boat, now they're able to go to George Calderoni and say like, hey, don't you see yourself playing with him? We'd love to have you, this, that, and the other. And it kind of, you know, those dominoes just kind of start to fall one after another. And other than that, it was like the very next one to go was John Pike, who's from Rumson Fairhaven. So he's an in-state product and quickly picked Princeton. And again, like, you know, you just are able to kind of get the dominoes falling from there. And then when you look at this Princeton class, and this is probably my criticism of the Penn State class, is just that like they don't have their goalie yet. And so for Princeton, when you look at the class, it's like just very well orchestrated, very well built between attackmen, midfielders, righties, lefties. You have your goalie in the boat. You have your faceoff guy in the boat. You have an LSM in the boat. Like, you just have a ton of structure to the class. And so I just think in general with the way that class is built, that, you know, there's a lot there for the Tiger faithful to be looking forward to.
Yeah. And I would agree. Like, I think it's a really well-built class. Like, you look at the middle of the field, you have Jack Sheppiel and John Pike, who are, you know, could play close defense, could play LSM, but they're very dynamic. So they're definitely have, you know, acquired some really great defensive playmakers. And then obviously Riley Woods, like, going to score a million goals for them. But John Lynch, like, I think he was kind of like surprisingly a little bit later recruit than, you know, some of the other five stars, but like, you know, just a really talented midfielder. I can see him fitting in right away and being a contributor. You know, like Finn Kilborn, another five-star on the list, got there. And then, of course, you know, George Caldroni, like pairing, you know, they had the Mad Dog connection, him and Riley Woods. Like, it almost seems unfair that you kind of have that familiarity from between those two going into college. Like, it's just a really, it's really cool to think about. You know, it's like, it speaks a lot to the way that Princeton's been playing on the field, but also recruiting. You know, it's like, this kind of feels like the consummation of, you know, several years of success, both on the playing field in the spring and on the summer circuit in the summer.
No doubt. And we're kind of working in reverse order here, but we'll go to number two, Notre Dame, currently sitting in the second spot. You mentioned JT Cross, right? So they got the number two player, the number two attackman, a true quarterback, a guy with some Irish blood in him already. And I think he's one that, you know, like when this cycle started, he was the guy that they were hoping to get. And so from that aspect of things, you have to be, you know, pretty confident and feel excited about that. And then when you continue to look down the line, right, like it's four top 20 players. And of those four, you have JT, who you could argue is, you know, one of the best Dodgers, speed, two hands, number two player in the class, right? So much to like there. And then you also have the number one defender in Leif Anderson, who is, to me, even more valuable because amongst his peers, there aren't a ton of the just like true erasers that also kind of like can put the ball on the ground and have a little bit of a handle, right? And so I don't think that the latter of those things is necessarily what defines his game, but I do think that he's just super valuable for how impressive he's been and how good of a cover he is and how impactful he is just in general. And then in addition to those two, as we mentioned, right, like top 20 guys, is Connor Morsell, a left-handed attackman that comes from great lacrosse pedigree, Haverford School out of Philly, a popular pipeline. And then one that's maybe not as familiar, but a public school kid from New Jersey, Nick Lagunowicz, who has an older brother at an ACC school. And so, like, from those aspects of things, like, you know, again, like, for you to be able to get the kid that, like, you know, a lot of people had their eyes on, but you definitely put your sights on early and is one of the most sought after kids in the class, a top defender in the class, a kid that has blood at other ACC schools, and then an attackman that is, you know, from one of the strongest pedigrees and pipelines in the sport. Like, I think all of those things are just like really, really advantageous, I would say, or just like impressive specs to be defining features of your class.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's really well balanced. Like, I can see that attack line of Cross, Morsell, Lagunowicz all on the field at some point in the future. It might not be right away, but at some point in the future. Yeah, Leif Anderson, huge. Like, Hayes Griffin, huge. They got their goalie in Jackson Gillis. They've got a face-off guy in Kane Quinault. Like, it's just very, very balanced, very kind of like business-like approach to it. Like, yes, let's go get some of the top guys like we did in JT Cross, but like, let's make sure that we're also, you know, resupplying right here, right? Reloading and making sure that we're good to go for the next couple of years.
And then the other aspect, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but the other aspect I would say about just this class, right, is Michael Van Basselier, right, out of LaSalle College in Philly. And again, keeping that popular pipeline going. He's also one of the highest ranked four stars in the class as the number 23 player. And so in general, when you look at the top 10 or top 100, you know, they have 9-10 guys. So plenty of guys that are represented on that list. And, you know, we're really sought after through this process. And Notre Dame just, you know, is one of the heavy hitters when it comes to winning recruiting battles.
Let's look at some of the other classes that are high performers. But is there any class that you really love that may not reflect itself on the rankings?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Another way to put it is like who's out punching, right? Like who's maybe out punching and fighting and winning some of those battles that I was just referring to that maybe don't pop off the page as like your typical recruiting battle winners. A couple of teams that I have in that category, I think Rutgers is doing a really good job right now. You maybe have a little bit of the beta effect going on there, but in general, I like their class and the way that that has sculpted out. But I think the number one team that kind of fits that mold to me right now is Delaware. And they don't have a ton of guys already committed, but the ones that they do are some really talented players, right? Andrew Chipperfield comes to mind. He was a guy that, you know, over the course of doing all of our calls, like, had plenty of Big Ten interest. Like, you know, there were a lot of big time programs that at least indicated that they liked his game and were interested. Jordani Rosario, offensively, the number 30 attackman, a 4-star. And just like, you know, there's so much to love about his game, but he's another one that, like, under different circumstances, you could have seen going ACC, Big Ten, Ivy. And again, like, I don't mean to diminish anything that Delaware has going on, but like I said, you kind of consider the institutions on their own without lacrosse, without, you know, coaches that do a good job of talent evaluation and, you know, selling their program in a meaningful way, AKA recruiting, right? That maybe just wouldn't have popped off the page in the same way. And so I've been really impressed with Delaware in that aspect. I would also add to this category, Denver. I think Denver has done a really nice job with this class of evaluating some guys that they either have the inside track on that are pretty good, or just in general landing some high caliber players. But the final team that I'll throw out as an answer to that, and this is kind of dependent upon coaching changes and the fact that there could have been a much bigger dip. And so I'm not, you know, it could have been more challenging to sculpt the class for this grad year, and that's Penn. I think Penn has done a nice job with this 2027 group that they have. They've landed Alex Dimnicku, one of the best face-off specialists in the class. James Brimhall, left-handed attackman that's been starting for St. Mary's and MIAA since day one, and plenty of other guys that that are, you know, really talented players. You know, we're pretty heavily sought after in the process. And so I think from that aspect, those are kind of the schools that kind of pop off the page as maybe like punching above their weight, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think that when I look at the Ivy League, I think it's, you know, they've always had good recruits, but I do think that I'm pretty impressed with both Brown and Dartmouth's class so far as well. Like, I look at Brown and I feel like a lot of these guys are like flyer players in the sense that, like, they could really take off once they get on campus. Like a guy like Rex Adamson, Danny Lopez, Hudson Higby, who I was a big fan of during the summer. Like, it's just a lot of really solid guys that I think, you know, when they get to campus and they're under the tutelage of Torpy, like, it could be a really great class. And then Dartmouth, you know, just like, it speaks to the momentum that they've had, you know, in the recruiting realm ever since Kerwin took over. And I just feel like the caliber of player that they're able to just go and get now is much higher than it's been in the past. And that continued with this class. You know, a guy like Luke Perriello going there is just going to be a huge two-way midfielder for them. Like Max Wong, I was a huge fan of his during the summer. You know, had a great summer with West Coast Stars. Teammate Harrison Jacobson as well on West Coast Stars. Like, it's just like a lot of really great players. And so I think for those two teams, like, we could see those teams, like, on the upside in the Ivy League going into the future, and I'm very impressed with what they've put together this summer so far.
Totally agree. In general, I think that this 2027 class is a really high academic group. I think mm-hmm. the Ivies have benefited from that in general, right? Cornell's class is also really impressive. Coming off of a national championship, you know, that's the type of thing that, like, you know, you're looking to do, right? You got to capitalize off of that type of success and not just, you know, continue to win games, but continue to turn those games on the field into wins off of the field in the recruiting world and keep that roster as stacked as possible.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you one question, and it kind of has to do with a bit of some of the classes that are a little bit more criticized in the sense that they took a little bit longer to kind of get going. And I think the three that really come to mind are Maryland, Duke, and Virginia, which are heavy hitters in the lacrosse sphere, but I think a lot of people are looking at the way that they've brought in players during this period and saying, like, hey, these teams are underperforming. What do you think about that point?
Yeah, Maryland is interesting. I agree that they were perhaps a little bit slow to get going, but I don't necessarily think that that's like a raise the alarm situation. And now as it stands, they have 5 top 100 players, one of the best top rated defenders in Evan March. And again, I think that, you know, that class maybe was a little bit slow to start to materialize, but it's a class that I think is still really talented in general. And so, you know, like we said, maybe that there was a little bit more panic in the first week or 10 days or so of September than in the, you know, second and third weeks when things kind of started to get rolling for them. Virginia is interesting, right? I think when you consider this and you look at the list and you don't see Virginia until all of the 5 stars are gone. And then you have to go again until you see them for a little bit when you're just scrolling the top 100, right? Like that is really interesting in itself. And then, who was the third one?
Duke, which...
Duke is interesting because I think they have a really, really, really good defensive class. I think Bodie Harmon is phenomenal in the cage. Deion Kitso's excellent defender. Again, when you look at this side, like Brady Berg listed as a midfielder, but for those who aren't familiar with his game, he's a short stick D mid and kind of like a true short stick D mid. And then you have Jaeger Zamiason, who can easily bounce back and forth between close defense and LSM. And then Ben Wechter, who is like a true just like athletic freak in the middle of the field, like an actual LSM, sideline to sideline, create chaos, and then push transition on the other side of it. And so when you look at their class as a whole, it is very defensive heavy outside of Finn French, who definitely fits the mold of two-way, right? And so like I don't think I can classify him as a true offensive player. Like, sure, he'll take offensive reps, but in general, when you look at this class, like defensively, it is as solid as you could hope for. Offensively, you know, they don't have a single offensive commit in the boat, and I think that at this point is shocking. So when it comes to, like, you know, if we were to do a subjective version, which we will, of these class rankings, right? Like, I think Duke would fall a little bit lower than both where they fall in the points and in the actual ranking when we do like a subjective version of it coming up soon.
Yeah, very fascinating. Because like you said, no marquee offensive recruit in this class. It's not a very big class overall. Only 6 guys right now, 2 of them 5 stars, but it is extremely defense heavy. So very interesting.
Part of what that tells me is that they were hoping and thinking and wishing that James was going to fall the Blue Devil way, right? And so now with him in Chapel Hill, I feel like, you know, that decision is just all the more extra weighted in a way that North Carolina has to capitalize, because otherwise it would have been an in-state rival, or could have been, I should say.
Yeah. All right, I think we should wrap it up here.
All right. If you don't have anything else, I think that was a really good session. I'm glad we were able to link and kind of get some of these takes off. In general, like we said, I think it's been a really fun group to watch it materialize. The aggressive schools that, you know, have that big selling, whether it's academic experience, and then a budget to match it, like you've just seen those schools be able to move at rates that are almost unprecedented and extremely impressive from like the fan side of things. If you are a fan of a certain institution that is able to move like that, you are certainly happy with what has been brought your way. We got a couple of heavy hitters that are, you know, doing some damage right away. And then now it's like, you know, everybody else is kind of, you know, trying to make their money count and land the best fit possible that's still out there. And there are plenty of awesome uncommitted players still around. So you can expect these class rankings, not just over the course of additional commitments to change, but certainly over the course of the next 2 years as players rise and fall and stocks go up and stocks go down. And so all those types of things will continue to change. And fortunately for fans, we will be here to continue to recap it all. So until next time, check out that DB.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.